I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 17, Episode 15, Solvable. This week, we heard the remaining testimonies from the trial, as well as Michelle Flores' police interview. Bob also pointed out massive gaps in this murder investigation, which has led to a lot of questions. We are sans Janet again this week, as she is off on assignment, but Bob and I are here to get into your listener theories and questions. But before we do that, do we have any housekeeping?
Just the one that's a listener had a question for housekeeping.
Yeah, Charlotte has one, says, when will the files be added to the website?
Charlotte, I'm glad you asked. They're up. I mean, I'm glad you asked, because when I saw that last night, I was like, oh, crap, I haven't put the file. Like, I've organized them onto my desktop, but I forgot to put them into the... So I think everything on the website is up to date through all of our episodes right now. So you have
perfect
all the different testimonies. You have Chris's PCR testimony, which is probably the longest one on there. So everything should be up now. We should be good to go and all caught up on that. So thanks for bringing that up, Sharla.
Perfect.
Other than that, I don't think we have any other housekeeping going on. We can get right into the content for this week. I guess I'll start with what you think, and then I'll go on my rant.
You know, it was nice to hear from all these people, but we just didn't hear anything. There was nothing, you know what I mean?
That describes the whole trial.
I know, and it's so disappointing. And there's so many things that I just don't understand. And I guess you pointed out in the episode that, like, maybe we wouldn't necessarily hear some of these answers as to, like, the character of the person in trial.
Right.
But why did we not hear from them any other time?
Well, that's the thing. Where's the police interviews? Where are the police interviews with the victims' families? Where are the police interviews with people that interacted with them that night, other than Michelle Flores? Like, where is it? They don't exist.
And it's weird that she, like, it is weird that she's the only one that they talk to, and it's because it has the note in it.
Well, and she's the one that, like, reported them missing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But there's just so much more that I feel like could have been done. And I know we're going to beat a dead horse by saying that, because you said in the episode that they could have done, you know, they could have followed up anything that she said, including going to the liquor store.
Well, that was the thing, is I wasn't really planning on that when I was writing the episode. Part of it was like, and you see, like, obviously, like, a lot of these episodes recently have been shorter, but it's like, I'm going to, like, okay, we're going to go through all the rest of the state's witnesses. We got, and then you go through them. It's like, their testimonies are a page. Like, it's short. I said 2 days. It wasn't even 2 days, the state's case. Mm-hmm. So in the trial, volume one is all the pretrial stuff, the voir dire. It's got the index and everything in it. And then the way it works is a volume of trial transcript is a day of trial.
Okay.
And that's not even 8 hours, because I don't know if any of you have ever been in a trial or served on a jury. Like, they're like, the, you know, you're supposed to, you know, the jury's reports at 8, and they were supposed to bring you out at 9, but it's never 9 because the judge and the lawyer is always talking about something, and they end up bringing you out at, you know, 9:30, 10 o'clock. and then you go a couple hours. Then if it's close to lunch, you know, they give you a break mid-morning, and then that's supposed to be 15 minutes. It turns into an hour, and then you come back, and then it's almost lunchtime, and they give you a break that's supposed to be an hour and ends up being an hour and a half because the judge is like, that's just how it works.
Yeah.
And then it's like, it's supposed to be done by 5, and they're like, well, there's always, and you'll see this in the transcript, there's always the, well, okay, well, it's 4 o'clock. How many, your next witness, how long do you think they're going to take? Should we, and usually they're like, I think it'll probably take me more than an hour. Okay, well, let's adjourn now, right? So it's not even a full day.
Yeah.
You're maybe in trial for 5 or 6 hours of a day, of a volume. The entire trial is 2 days, 2 volumes. And that includes the jury instructions,
mm-hmm.
the state and the defense closing arguments, and every motion in between. So like the state's case was maybe a day and a half, if that. It's hard to tell because there's no time. There's not, I mean, you could pick it apart by based on like the bench conferences and stuff. Yeah. But yeah, like it's insane to me how little attention was given to this case. It already was when we were looking at the investigation, but then in the trial, it's like there was just nothing. To me, the state came out there like he gave this kind of half-assed confession. And we learned, and not just that he's going to say it, but that they manipulated Larry into saying, because remember, his words were that they told him before he went out where Chris Bynum was so he could identify him. They told him that Chris Bynum confessed. They told him to say Chris Bynum's name.
Right.
And so they're like, well, if he says Chris Bynum did it and we show him that confession, that's it. And you heard the closing argument. Like, that was it. We know he did that. Why? Because of evidence? No. Because of a witness? No. Why do we know he did this? Why do we know that he had a gun? Because he said he had a gun.
Because he said he had one.
Mm-hmm.
So for a person like me that's a layman in this, what would standard procedure be? And I understand you're not a homicide investigator. You were an arson investigator. You're not an attorney. But from your point of view, what would standard procedure be to follow like a report like Michelle's?
Okay, so let's take it even a step back from there for investigating the case. It's different. The arson investigation doesn't really apply because my job is a... You can look at an arson investigator's job more as like a crime scene technician.
Okay.
Right. So everything is on the crime scene. Like I'm not, you know, I would interview people and like in some interrogations, not really what we were doing, but I mean, we were taught how to interview people and how to, you know, to draw stuff out of them.
Okay.
But that's it. But if I would, but I've been for 10 years, I've been investigating murder cases and I've looked at how other investigators do it. So I think I can speak somewhat intelligently about that. So in this case, go back to everything like we've learned from like Jim Clemente over the years. Step one, always victimology. You know, well, even before that, like first day on the crime scene, like you get there, you're at the crime scene. Immediately, you start canvassing the neighborhood, like for the house crime scene and for the ball field crime scene. Start knocking on every door.
Okay.
Did you see anybody here? Did you see anybody leave the house? Did you hear anything? Did you see any weird cars park in the parking lot? Like anything or in the driveway? Anything like that, like that's step one, and then talk to any witnesses that were there. So then you go, and obviously Michelle Flores had reported it. You know she was with the victim. That's part of your victimology assessment. But that's what you want to do is start establishing the movements of the victims. A little easier at the house crime scene because they were at home, right? So you're not tracking a bunch of movements, but you still need to study victimology because somebody came in there, and what we know now. Somebody came in there with drugs and started smoking drugs with them and then shot them, right?
Right.
That tells me, like, from a profiling perspective and a very, like, elementary perspective, this was someone that knew them. I don't think, I've never been in the drug scene at all. People are welcome to message me privately because I know that we have some folks that, you know, that have been in their, in their past. But from what I've, the discussions I've had with people who have kind of been in that scene, this is not a dealer.
Right.
Like a dealer is just a Joe Blow dealer that you buy from is not coming to your house to deliver drugs to you and then going to be in your house when you start smoking them.
Yeah.
Like you don't stay a dealer very long doing shit like that.
It also seems and definitely no excuses, but it also seems like the first investigators when they first get to the house and they start one of the canvas, they wouldn't know about the drugs, right? Because the toxicology report takes a little bit to come back.
No, but you can tell reading between the lines that they made assumptions.
Okay.
I think they assumed, just like, you know, what they say to our Liz's mother, like, well, you know what kind of person she was, right? So I think they assumed these were throwaways to begin with. This is going to answer a lot of your questions later as to the why this happened, right? But so in a proper investigation, right? So you want to know, you canvass the neighborhood. You need to know what's going on. You know, what were they doing in their life? Particularly, you have some solid leads. The house crime scene is more difficult, but with Liz and Sheila, you've got some solid leads, right? The first person you talk to is Michelle. Okay, so you talk to Michelle, and Michelle tells you she made a phone call, she made a page, whatever, and then she went to Sports Life. I think that's what it was called.
I do think that's
Sports Life liquor store. It's on, you know, 20 and whatever down the road. Immediately, you go there, right? It's within 24 hours. Mm-hmm. You go there and show them, like, have you seen this person? Were these two women here last night? Did you see who they're with? Do you have surveillance footage? Let's, because I guarantee you, like I said, and we're planning a trip to go to Gary. I want to go to, that's one of the places I want to go and hopefully find somebody that might know, did they have surveillance cameras all the way back in the day? I guarantee you they did. So you go start finding out who did they come into contact with. Try to figure out where they went to next. I don't think there's any way you don't get, at that time of night, you don't get some kind of lead. You know, you have two white women in the Etna neighborhood, which is predominantly a black neighborhood. Two white women that go to this liquor store at 11 o'clock at night. Someone who worked that night is going to recognize them, is going to remember them, is going to give you some idea of who they came into contact with there. So like that's the easy first step. So then you've got like this two-sided approach for me as an investigator is I'm tracking their steps, trying to figure out who they came into contact with. And then on the house side, it's a deep study of victimology and I'm taking my time. You know, now let's say this tip did come in and let's say it's real. And that leads them to, my guess is it led them to Shaky is probably how they got to Chris. But we'll talk about that in a minute, too. You get this story. You bring Chris. Fine. Bring Chris Bynum in for questioning. Says they were at the VFW, whatever, if you did a legitimate investigation. We know the VFW also has surveillance footage. Okay. Well, you get the story from Shaky, who says, oh, yeah, he was there and he had a gun. He pulled this gun out on me. Easy to verify. You go talk to everybody that was at the VFW and look at the surveillance footage. Find out what happened. Find out if they were together. Find out when they left. Find out if they left together, what they were driving, all these different things, right? So these are all like easy steps. I can't tell you where those leads would lead them to. But what I can tell you is it would put them closer to the actual answer of what happened. Like those are just very, very basic steps.
Right.
And then as far as the trial goes, you know, what's missing from this trial, generally speaking, you'll have the family members come because you have to like, there's weird things in a trial where you have to identify the facts of the case. So if I'm doing a trial to convict somebody for murdering Liz Daly Ayers, I have to establish that the victim is Liz Daly Ayers. So you bring up a relative, come up, you can identify that's her. She was the one that was killed. That's check the box off.
Okay.
Right. So that part has to happen. And then usually you go right from the beginning. You pull the 911 calls, which we never heard, were never put into evidence, was never made available to the defense as far as I've been able to tell, right? So you play the 911 call. You just start walking through the whole thing.
And right, and there should be two, right? There should be one from the house and one from the ball field.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you have Terrell Triggs's 911 call. And also, I don't even know if Michelle Furr's called 911 or if she just called the non-emergency line. But you start like laying the foundation for what happened and then walk through all of your investigative steps that led, like the fact that you get through this entire trial and the jury never learns why Chris Bynum was brought in as a suspect to begin with is insane.
Yeah.
Like that is insane. And it should put up giant red flags to people. Like the fact that we don't know from the reports is problem one, but like it didn't even come out at trial. They never even made an attempt. Tells you that the way they got to Chris was not an honest way.
Mm-hmm.
If it was an honest way, they would have told you that's normal procedure. You know, so there's all these like glaring gaps. And it was just like when I really looked at the brevity of the trial, everything that was missing from the trial, everything that was missing from the investigation, there is no question in my mind. It's definitely my opinion, but there, in my opinion, there's no question that this was not an honest investigation. That they are intentionally hiding stuff from the jury. They were hiding stuff from the defense. And I wouldn't even say like they don't know if they got the right. I don't think they give a shit if they got the right person.
Yeah, just trying to clear a case.
Yeah. And here's my evidence for that. Larry Brooks told them there were two people. They convicted one and closed the case.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't care.
Right. Yeah, I mean, not only that, Larry told you there's two. this supposed tip that may or may not have came, had three,
right?
So they still only, yeah, that's so crazy to me.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
So we kind of touched on it just for a split second, but we're going to go for it. Olivia asks, how is it not a Brady violation if the prosecutors didn't turn over the note? If that had the number of a different Chris, that could be in the information the defense needed to boost their arguments.
So you're spot on. It is a potential Brady violation. Here's the problem. The note, they say, does not exist. So in order to prove it's a Brady violation, you have to prove it exists, it's exculpatory, it would be material, meaning it could have changed the outcome of the trial, and that it was withheld from the defense. Now, I think, and I don't know if this has been done through any appeal. I haven't seen it, but if not, it may be a possible avenue. I think the argument can be made that we have proof it exists when you look at Michelle Fleur's statement. It literally says the notes attached to that report.
Mm-hmm.
So like it did exist, which means it was withheld. But even with that, how do you prove that? And Michelle Fleur is deceased, by the way.
Oh.
Not that she would remember what the number was anyway.
Right.
But how do you prove that the number they said was on that note was in fact the actual number that was on that note? And how do you prove who, you don't have the information you need? And I think it's brilliant. I'm sure a deep dive into this entire Lake County prosecutor's office at that time and the Gary PD and their detective bureau, which we know we're going to get into later, that there was a lot of corruption in the detective bureau. Like, you don't pull this off in this way, this easily, unless you've done it a lot. So when you look at like Jody Hill's case in Benton Harbor,
mm-hmm.
like it didn't take long to find all like documented glaring corruption. You know, it wasn't hard to figure out what they did, because I don't think they did anything that complex before. This is not like that. Like to take a note and say, oh, steps like when we interview people, we're not going to record it. We're going to type in what we're saying they said and have them sign it and present it so it looks like a transcript. That way we can say whatever we want. So she could have said, yeah, it has this number 12345 on it. And they go, great. And they type in the report. She said the number was 37856.
Mm-hmm.
It's that easy, you know, to put whatever number it, and it can be typed up after the fact. It could be edited after the fact. As a matter of fact, I need to look. I'm wondering, I'm going to do this right now, ooh, live.
In real time.
While we're doing this, I think I have it right here.
While you think about it, I never thought about that too. The idea, I know that we've talked about it at length, the idea that they typed up this report, making it look like it's a transcript, but it's not. But I never even thought about the idea that they could still type it in real time as like they're pretending it's a transcript.
Yeah.
But who's going to read? You know what I mean? Like if I'm giving a statement and it's 20 pages long, I'm probably not going to read all 20 pages to make sure that what I said is accurate back to them before I sign it.
And this is what I was looking for. I'm looking at that statement, uh-huh. Michelle Flores' statement right now. And on page one, where she gives basic information, at the bottom of the page, it's signed by Michelle Flores and Detective Galt.
Okay.
On page two, the page where she gives the phone number, where the phone number is typed in, it's signed by, I don't know who, it looks like Joseph Moxley on the side, not signed by Michelle Flores. Page three, now we're beyond, this one does not have the phone number, signed by Michelle Flores. And it's like Galt or Moxley. It's hard to read the handwriting. And page four, the final one is signed by all four pages are signed by Michelle Flores, except the page that has the phone numbers on it.
Mm.
That's something I need to pass on to the attorneys because that's super interesting.
That is interesting.
Because so what that means, remember how I told you is so, and right there, the end of page one ends with Michelle is speaking. She says, and told her to meet him at the Sporting Life Liquors. They never came back. The start of page two is another, says answer by, so still Michelle talking. Well, when I got up, sitting by the phone on the table was this number showing this detective a page with the phone number on it. That was the part, remember I said it doesn't make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because like she's responding to a question.
But there's no question.
But there's no question. And the pages are numbered. It says 1 of 4, 2 of 4, 925, 930 is what's typed onto it. That's a problem. And then the next page, page three, starts with, do you know Chris's name? So literally there's this page that has the entirety, and I'll show you exactly so you can see what it looks like.
Okay. Yeah.
So here's page one. QAQAQ, I don't know where my cursor is. Question, answer, question, answer, question, answer, question, answer. She's answering.
Uh-huh.
You see where she signed it?
Yep.
Page two, she's answering, and there's this long drawn, and there's cop speak in there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And there's no question.
Yeah, and that's where she gives the phone number, see attached. Now, again, showing this detective, this number. Like, that's written like a report.
Mm-hmm. It sure is.
And then, quick question. Another long narrative, no signature, and then back to QA with a signature on page three.
Wow, that is very interesting and very strange.
I can't believe I didn't catch that before, but I'm certainly catching it now. I don't remember where I started that conversation, but that's super interesting. But yeah, we were talking about Brady violation.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to prove Brady, you have to have the note. Like, and that as far as them, them doing this in a way that makes it impossible. If the note is bad evidence, and you toss the note, and you just say, and I don't think Graddick ever, I don't think he paid enough attention to this case to even realize that it said in there that note should exist. I think he just took the word for it that it's mm-hmm. on the report. If they just tossed it and it doesn't exist, you can claim all kinds of shit about them throwing away the evidence. But what you can't do is make a compelling argument to a judge that it's exculpatory based on some hypothetical of what you think it's going to say.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the problem with it being a Brady violation is they did a great job of making it disappear. Sue says, actually, Bob, that's not a problem. This is awesome and helpful. We know they are liars. Now we have a tiny bit of proof. Congrats. Oh, thanks, Sue. Okay, we'll move on from that. But that
well, this is still kind of in the same vein. Charlotte asks, if police had the number that didn't belong to Chris on the note, why wouldn't they just go after that person? Not a lawyer, but testifying to a note written by someone else when you don't have the note or the person who wrote it sounds like hearsay. Do we know for sure if the note was collected or photographed? And Ashley also has a similar question, and it says, I assume at this point there is no way to verify what number was actually on the note. I just don't get the lack of investigation. It seems like it would be easier to pull the phone record than to strong arm someone into a confession, whether they believe to be the person true or not, or to be the person or not. They'd have to be completely inept to think Chris's confession was true or accurate.
So here's the thing. Partially, I'm thinking this through in real time as we just went through this issue that I just pointed out with the timing. So here's a hypothetical scenario. They got the note. It had a number on it. They take it. They have no idea. It's not like CSI where, you know, somebody clickety clacks on a keyboard and they immediately know who it belongs to. They're going to have to file like subpoenas with pager companies and go through warrants and hoops to find out who that number belongs to. So if they have that in the back of their mind, then they get Chris in and they get Chris to give his statement. My theory as of this moment, based on what we just found with Michelle, the fact that page seems completely out of place and the fact that Michelle didn't sign that one page, I think they went back and edited the page to fit with Michelle's or with Chris's phone number. That's the only thing that makes sense to me, is if they're like, they're trying to build a case against him, but we'll just switch this out and we'll throw out the page that she signed and we'll just edit it in the computer and change the phone number and then put it in the mix of the rest of the pages, and we're good to go. Now we have a connection. So I think the confusion there that people have is, I think it comes from TV. Like they would have had that number and could have immediately found out who that number belonged to. Mm-hmm. I think they, but also that's the other thing. Reason I was bringing it up. So the question is, was it Charlotte or whoever said that it would be hearsay?
Charlotte, yes.
Yeah. You're right. There are issues with it, with somebody just, you know, testifying to what was in the note without. Now, I think it could be. It could have been objected to as hearsay, I think. I don't know if it would have held up if it was like her note. She physically saw it. She's talking about what she saw. Mm-hmm. There could make there, again, I'm not a lawyer either, so I don't know if they could make a hearsay argument.
Did they bring up the note at trial, though?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, at trial, they brought up the note, but no number.
But no number.
She said there was a note in it. Well, yeah, actually, she testified to the note that it said Chris on it. So if she could do that, she could testify to the number. But we know, so I'm going to read this to you, what is in the report. So it says this is Michelle talking. This is in the weird page that doesn't fit with anything and is not signed. It says, well, when I got up, sitting by the phone on the table was this number showing this detective a page with 890-1277 C attached and Chris underneath it. Then I pushed *69 to see what number he had called from, and it was 938-1751 C attached. Now, again, showing this detective the number 890-1277 and saying, this is in Liz's handwriting. So according to this, yeah, that not only was that did the note exist according to this,
mm-hmm.
but the detective took possession of it and attached it to the report. It says C attached.
I also don't remember *69 working like that.
Didn't they just call somebody back?
I thought it would just call the number back.
It doesn't show you.
Yeah. I thought it would just call the number that called you. I don't think it ever showed you the number.
This is a weird live doing things, but I'm going to check this out.
And maybe I'm wrong, but I do not remember *69 giving you a number. I remember you being able to reply to it. So I'm going to read this question while we're doing this because we don't have an answer and we've already kind of answered it. Heather asks, is there any way to go back and find out whose phone or pager numbers this belongs to?
Well, again, we have to have the note,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's the problem with it is without the note, and that's the clever part about it. As long as the note that was at one point attached to this report doesn't exist, no. Now, if the defense had it, then if it existed and they knew what the number was, absolutely, you could find exactly who it belonged to. Good catch, Zach. I just checked this to verify. In the year 2000, dialing *69 on a landline would call back the last number that called you. It did not tell you what the number was, which is why it was a common feature used before caller ID became widespread.
Yeah.
Because you didn't know who called. So again, bullshit.
Right. So in the report, they say that
she's, yeah, the report says, and we'll read that again. Boy, this is I guess it's a good one, but it's a different follow-up.
I like it, though.
She says, then I pushed *69 to see what number he had called from, and it was 938-1751. That's bullshit.
Right.
That did not work like that. And it says see attached.
Right.
Like, see attached what?
Oh.
So there are serious, serious problems with this. So now I'm working on a main episode in my head while we're trying to do this. But this is your main this week.
I love it. I love it. Sarah asks, did the defense make any effort to pull phone records and Chris's pager records?
I don't think so. I've never seen any records that they did. I don't think Graddick paid any real attention to any of this. I think Graddick saw that he had confessed and didn't put much effort into it at all. And again, if you're an attorney and you get the police file, and the police file shows that your client's phone number was written on a piece of paper by the victim right before she left and met her killer, he's probably like, well, I don't want to dig any deeper into these phone numbers. That's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
Again, it's clever. It's brilliant the way they did this. They made it so, especially you have a court-appointed attorney that's overwhelmed with other cases, doesn't have time to really dig into this. It doesn't seem like much of a case. They're not going to put in the effort to track that down. Because, you know, if I'm the attorney, when I see that report, the first thing I'm doing is saying, let me see that fucking note.
Right.
Like, where is the note? You said it's attached. Why don't I have it? You said it says this number. Where is it?
Mm-hmm. Man, I feel like as a court-appointed attorney, too, I don't know. Obviously, I'm a layman talking about this, but like, you look at it, you have the police report that says the number's there. You have the confession. You're like, hey, I'm just going to get this guy the best deal I can get.
Right.
Because he's already this far.
Yeah.
Hey, everybody. Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger fuel centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Sue's asking in the chat, she said, why would the police think Star 69 worked like that? Did the police have some special Star 69 that would do that? Who knows? I mean, to me, the more and more, as we're sitting here in real time, I'm thinking like that, I think that entire part of that report was typed up after the fact. I think it was edited and typed up after the fact.
So Liz in the said, could her phone bill attached for the number that she Star 69? But it would take so long for that to come around.
That number was read the day after.
Mm-hmm.
She showed him something, the number she got from Star 69, which was the number that the number got that called her.
Right.
Right. And it's supposed to like call back. Yeah. That's our, it would call back the last number that called you.
And just to clarify, the number that has been given in the report is actually Chris's pager number.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's the number that Chris said was his pager number in his report, but that could be bullshit too.
Okay.
That's in the file that Timmy that works with Nikki.
Right.
In you know, his like tracking all this stuff down, he has a list of all the phone numbers, but the source for that number, because you know, they got the case years later. They got it like 4 years ago. So it's 20 years after the fact. the source for that number was from Chris's statement where he said that's his pager number.
Okay.
But my guess is that I would assume that's probably, if the way this plays out is Chris gives his statement, gives his pager number, and they go back and remove a page and replace it with this one that has his number, they probably think, okay, that's actually his pager number, so let's just write a report that says she had that pager number written down.
Mm, damn, that's craziness. All right, Sue says, did all three people named in the alleged tip know each other?
I don't know. Shaky and Chris did know each other. They were at the VFW together that mm-hmm. night. I do not know if they knew Terrell. I'm sure Nikki usually listens to these and she'll let me know.
I do vaguely remember Chris. Again, it's all what Chris has said in custody, but I do feel like Chris said something that he knew Terrell from a work program or something.
I think you're right.
Something yeah. along those lines.
Yeah. For Job Corps or for something Job like Corps, that. Yeah. But again, that's in the same statement where he said that, you know, he was standing outside while Terrell was inside.
Correct.
Shooting them.
Yeah.
While two of them just stood there and watched.
Shelley says, can you refresh my memory why we think Amp was in the drug scene? Wasn't it stated in an earlier episode the toxicology results for the three house victims didn't have any indication of regular drug use, unlike the ball field victims?
I don't think he would. Well, it depends what you mean by the drug scene. So the state kind of presented this and the detectives, you know, and when I say the state, it's because it's through Larry's words.
Mm-hmm.
So in Larry's statement, that's just like Michelle's, right? It says that, you know, Amp was a dealer and he would sell, and that, remember, it was the whole like it was heroin because it smelled like spoiled milk.
Oh, yeah,
That whole thing. But when Larry testified later, he said that was all bullshit. He said he thinks maybe they smoked marijuana, but that was it. And yeah, the tox screen, like, I don't think Amp was a dealer. Yeah. I don't think he was a dealer. I don't think he was even a chronic user of anything other than maybe marijuana. You know, I think that, you know, probably it's some, you know, because his tox screen showed he hadn't smoked crack or cocaine or done any of that within, you know, days prior to this. It was mm-hmm. just that one night. Not to mean that he never had before. But yeah, I don't, whatever, depending what your definition of in the drug scene is, no, I don't think he was a dealer or anything like that. But I think that's how it was presented.
Oof. Jeff says, I know there was a simple answer to this question, but why didn't the defense put officers Galt and Dame on the stand themselves? And Kelly and Hannah actually had the same question.
So interestingly, before Donald's testimony, there was a motion to suppress where Galt, so in the way it reads, because it's not really explained in it why, but it seems as though Graddick doesn't want Galt to testify.
That's interesting.
Because there's like this short like testimony outside the presence of the jury with Galt where they question him a little bit, and then he's never called. But it's listed under a motion to suppress. So for some reason, he didn't want him, which again, that tells me he probably thinks he's got a guilty client or got a, you know, probably doesn't think it's going to do any good. Because the other thing is, even if you put Galt on, right, what evidence do you have as a defense attorney to, because you assume that if this is a frame job by the police, they're not going to go up and admit it was a frame job.
Right.
So probably the only thing that happens is it gets worse. Dame is a different story. And I guess I'm giving a little bit away I'm working on two Sundays from now is episode right now. Dame was MIA. So there's a short bench conference at one point in the trial where they're talking about what witnesses are you going to call, how long is it going to take. And Graddick says it's Collins, the prosecutor, and Graddick and the judge talking. And the judge is kind of at that same point, like I was talking about, like, how long is this going to take? How many witnesses do you have or whatever? And Graddick says something to the effect of, well, I want to get Dame in here. And Collins is like, good luck finding him. Like, we haven't heard. Essentially, she says like, oh, well, he's disappeared. Right before trial, conveniently, Officer Dame disappears. So I mean, there's the answer to that. Is as far as Galt, and that's the thing, is Dame would have been, like, Galt, they could have put on, I don't know what Galt would have said.
Yeah.
They could have questioned him. My guess is the best they could have done would be to question him to see if there was any indication that Chris was forced into signing that confession, or maybe question him about what Chris said, that, you know, he talked to Galt and Galt knew his dad or whatever. And that's what's in the motion to suppress. They talk about, like, did you know his dad? Did you know his family or whatever? And then that's it. And then he's not called. I don't know what's going on there. But Dame did have devastating testimony for the state. Dame, they had Dame's report, which no one was able to read in. It was, they were not able to get it in because it wasn't their report. They tried to get Dame's report in through Donald. They tried to get it in, I think, through, I don't remember who else it was, but they're like, no, they can't speak to that. It's hearsay. It's not their report.
That's so strange. I mean, there's no legal action for Dame being...
I don't, I mean, that's a...
Like, if they were to try to subpoena him, there was no legal action?
It certainly doesn't seem like there was much effort. It seemed like he just accepted, like, oh, well, that sucks. Anyway, let's move on. Like it was just, but it was the way Colin said it was like, I think her actual words were, yeah, good luck. We can't find him anywhere or something like that.
That doesn't make any damn sense to me whatsoever.
Yeah. I mean, it makes perfect sense. It just sucks.
Well,
right?
Yeah, I guess it makes sense. I just mean the lack of effort of trying to.
It's like, man, how devastating would it be to have Larry Brooks tell the jury that he knows for sure it was Chris Bynum, mm-hmm. and then have Dame come up on the stand with his report and say, I talked to Larry Brooks right then and there, and he told me he had no idea who it was.
Yeah, that would not be good.
Yeah.
And the whole Galt thing is interesting, too, because I guess from Graddick's point of view, while you have the reports, you don't know what Galt is going to say, even though the reports say one thing. So it would right. be really iffy for the defense to call an investigator up, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if that's true, but it seems like, in my opinion, it would just be very iffy.
Yeah, it's not going to probably be very fruitful for you.
Yeah. All right. So we are to our last question, and this is from Kathy. And it's a little snarky, and I love it. It says, so was there only one Chris in Gary, Indiana at this time? I'm still not sure how we got to Chris Bynum with this info.
Yeah, good question. So this is my theory. I want to be clear, this is a theory. The more and more I'm digging into this and trying to understand what happened here,
mm-hmm.
I think one way or another, Shaky got on their radar. This is just my theory. I think, and perhaps there was a tip that said it was Shaky and Chris, say, for example. Like you said, how many Chris's are there? There's a lot of Chris's.
Yeah.
And then I think they probably started looking for Shaky because they knew he's got a record. They know who he is. And they find out Shaky was with Chris Bynum. And that's the only thing I can think of. Because again, they've never made clear why they were looking for Chris Bynum.
Right.
So that's my assumption, is that they got to Chris through Shaky.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably more to the story than just Shaky coming and giving that statement.
That is the most, I hadn't thought about that, but that is the most plausible explanation, that there were the tip gave Chris without a last name.
Yeah.
They come across Shaky, who's with a Chris.
Right.
That's, I never put that together, but that's at least a plausible explanation. That doesn't mean it's accurate, but that's a plausible.
Yeah, and if that's the case, so let's kind of think through, like, how that shook out. Let's look at, like, again, hypothetical, based on just what I think happened, based on what I've seen so far. They've got these homicides that they don't really give a shit, other than they want to clear their case.
Mm-hmm.
They're the murder capital of the United States at this point. They need to clear their cases. They got cases, they've got five victims that are all throwaways as far as they're concerned. They get some tip that says, oh, it was this Shaky and Chris, whatever. So they start looking for Shaky because they know who he is, at mm-hmm. least. They start looking for him, find out he's with this Chris Bynum guy. All right, let's try to find both these guys. They find Chris Bynum first, and they're just like, let's just shake this guy down, right? And so they start to get the confession on him. Let's say everything Chris says happened. It's true, right? So they manipulate him. They threaten him. They deny him a lawyer. Standard practice for these guys. They get him to sign this statement. And they're like, okay, well, this statement's not true. We need to fix that. But at least we got him now saying that he was there when the murders happened. How can we continue to build this case? Okay, well, we got that statement from Michelle Flores. He gave us a phone number. Why don't we let's edit that page. In the number he gave us, let's put that number there. And now we got him. And then meanwhile, they bring in Shaky. Shaky gives his story. And now it's a matter of, now we got a real drawn out investigation and a hard trial. We got him saying he did it. So then let's put them together. So Shaky threatens Chris. I genuinely think, I don't think this was ever about them solving the case. It was just about them finding a way to get an easy conviction. So then they bring Chris back in. They already know Chris is pliable. Gets the threats from Shaky, comes back in, you change your story, you know, take him out of it. Give us a story that actually works, where you actually pulled the trigger. He gives him the story. Case closed. That's it. Done. Cleared it. We're out of there. I think that was the full extent of their investigation.
Well, and unfortunately, or fortunately, however you look at it, it sounds like, you know, everybody's got a button, and they found Chris's button, which was his fiance and child.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody's got a button, right?
Right.
So they just unfortunately found his easily.
Yeah.
To make him do this.
Yeah. This whole case is tried. And I think Richard, we didn't put it on the outline, but Richard just kind of made a comment in there, was talking about that, you know, the problem is this case was solvable, but it's probably not so much now. It is certainly going to be more difficult, but I still think it is.
Yeah.
I still think there's got to be a way to find the people. As they say, the streets know, mm-hmm. and if you know the right strings to pull on, and I think we're getting there.
Yeah,
I think it can be broken open. I hope, but you're right, man. It's a tough one because, you know, the note. That's the worst part about this whole thing. If there was a note, that's the thing that makes me so furious about this entire thing. Is from Michelle Fleur. Like, this case could have been simply and easily solved. After Michelle Fleur's statement, she told him where they went, a place where there could be witnesses, the place where she met likely whoever killed her. And you had the phone number or the pager number for the person that she was going to meet. All they had to do was investigate that.
Mm-hmm.
All they had to do was investigate that little bit. In this case, could have been properly and easily. This was not a hard case to solve. And that's what's the most frustrating part about the whole thing is. And that's why, you know, I titled the episode Solvable, because that was my takeaway from the whole thing. It was, yeah, we're getting the rest of the information like we always do. This is what happened at trial. We need to know all that. But it's just infuriating to me to realize, like, this wasn't a hard case. This was not a hard case at all.
Mm-hmm.
This should have been an easy case. And it was, and they had to take an even easier way out of this easy case. It's horrible. It's tragic. We're going to continue on. You guys make sure you tune in on this Sunday. This Sunday, we're going to go over how the state put all this together. So you've heard now the entirety of the evidence put forth to Chris. We're going to go through their closing arguments. The best story wins. What did they tell the jury? How do they piece this together in a narrative? I know I just realized that I mentioned earlier about what was said in the closing arguments, but that's because I already recorded that. But you all haven't heard it yet. You're going to hear it on Sunday. So make sure you tune in, and we'll talk to you guys next week.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kay Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been
Truth and Justice.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.